All right, good morning. I think it's about time for us to get started. So this quarter we're covering the miracles of Jesus, and my specific topic was Jesus' power over nature, which is interesting because all miracles are technically over nature because they're supernatural. They transcend the natural order of things. But then I got to thinking, technically, casting out demons is a miracle, but that's not controlling nature. So I thought that was interesting. That might be the only kind of miracle that doesn't necessarily fit in that category. So I'd never thought of that before. But specifically what Mike wanted me to cover was things like Christ's power over weather, Christ's power over physical laws, power over life, something along those lines. So that's what we'll be looking into this morning. So in Matthew 8, verses 23 through 27, first we're going to talk about Jesus' power over weather, some of the significant factors that go into that miracle, and then specifically some application that we can draw from a few of these different categories. So, Royce, would you like to read verses 23 through 27 for me?
Yeah, when he had got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." But he said unto them, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" Then he arose and he rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be, that even the winds and the sea obey him?"
I don't know if you've ever gone through Scripture and just looked at this, but have you ever noticed how God is very oftentimes associated with weather? Have you noticed that? It's interesting. Turn to the book of Job. We'll look at a few of these. Turn to the book of Job. Go to Job 36. Job 36, we'll begin in verse 26. It says, "Behold, God is great, and we know him not. Neither can the number of his years be searched out. For he maketh small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Also can any understand the spreadings of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle? Behold, he spreadeth his light upon it and covereth the bottom of the sea. For by them judgeth he the people. He giveth meat in abundance. With clouds he covereth the light and commandeth it not to shine by the cloud that cometh betwixt. The noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor." So passages like this all throughout the book of Job. And even if this is... you see a lot of these comments made by the three different men, the three friends of Job, which we have no reason to believe were inspired. But even if they weren't inspired, the fact still stands that they still associated God with weather, which in and of itself is interesting. But we think, well, at least I think, and you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I think Elihu, not necessarily inspired, but he was speaking for God. He did bring clarity to the matter, and so I'm much more comfortable reading something that he said than maybe one of the other three men. So, and taking it as legitimate, if that makes sense. So we find things in the book of Job. We know from Job 38:1 that God spoke with Job out of a whirlwind, another evidence of God being associated with weather. What about in the book of Exodus? Turn to Exodus 19. Exodus 19. Randy, would you like to read 19:16?
Yes, sir. "And it came to pass on the third day of the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and the voice of the trumpet exceedingly loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled."
So you have thunder, you have lightning, you have a thick cloud on the mount. Now turn to Revelation 4. Revelation 4, we'll make a quick comparison. Victor, would you read Revelation 4 and verse 5?
And from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunderings, and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God.
Okay, so again, you see essentially the same points being made. And then 11:19, chapter 11, verse 19, includes that same list, except it also includes hail. And then other passages include earthquakes and things like that. So I think it's interesting that that connection is definitely there in Scripture. I'll give you one more. Jesus says at least twice during his ministry that the coming of the Son of Man would be like lightning in the sky, which I thought was pretty cool. If you want to look those up, that would be Matthew 24:27. And Luke 17, verse 24. But back in Matthew 8. Back in Matthew 8. I wanted to make a quick note about one of the words here. Verse 24, it says, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves, that he was asleep. The Greek word there implies being hidden. The ship was hidden or concealed in the waves. For anyone that's ever been on a boat before, when it starts getting choppy, that's when you start getting nervous. But when the ship is starting to be covered by the waves, that's there's definitely a problem there. And so they're definitely afraid. They definitely have their concerns. But Jesus responds and he says, why are you fearful, O ye of little faith? What's the point? Why does he get on to his disciples for what would seem like a biological response of self-preservation? You know, we're about to perish in this storm. Why would he rebuke them, in a sense, for being fearful? Yeah. So it wasn't the fact that, you know, you shouldn't be afraid of storms. It's you shouldn't be afraid of the storm because I'm here with you. And we'll see that several times throughout several texts that we'll look at this morning.
And on top of that, it's not like they had not already experienced the miracles of Jesus. It's like, okay,
yeah,
he's done other things. Why would we panic rather than just saying, you know, he's with us. He's saved us. He'll save us.
Yeah, and that's something else that I kind of want to get into this morning. Of it's not wrong to fear. It's not wrong to be afraid. The Bible puts a lot more emphasis on the dangers of cowardice. And we'll talk about the differences between the two of being afraid and being cowardly.
Matthew 8, I think verse 27 there. They answered and said, what manner of man is this?
Right.
And that was the object lesson. He fixed to show them that he's more powerful than even what seemed to be.
Yeah, and something that stood out to me is despite the fact that he had that power, he was still in just as much danger as they were. You know, so it's interesting that he doesn't freak out and, oh, okay, all right, well, let's perform the miracle. He stays composed. That stands out to me in every single one of these instances. Whenever they're on the boat and the storm comes, he stays composed. He keeps his head and he stays calm. So just a quick question of application. When things go wrong in my life, do I lose my head or do I stay composed? I think that's important because the world has every right to something's gone wrong, mass panic, you know. But for Christians, I think it should be different. I think it should be different. And just because Jesus said these words to his disciples don't necessarily mean that, at least in application, they can't come forward to us. And I think the point is still the same. You know, when I'm being persecuted, when I'm struggling financially, whatever the case is, how do I respond? Do I pout or play the victim? Do I get angry or blame God? Do I wring my hands with worry that just renders me useless? I think all three of those are very dangerous responses whenever bad things come in life. You know, of course they're going to come. And again, it's not bad to have an emotional response to those. It's when we shut down and we're not able to function anymore. I think that's when it becomes dangerous. So.
Philippians 4:13, I mean, mm-hmm. No matter if it turns out and it doesn't get better, or does it get better, the strength that you're going to have just to get over through it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, and that reminds me of Ephesians 6. A verse that's always stood out to me, I forget which verse it is specifically, but it's the one that says, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Sometimes I think I might try to be strong on my own behalf, you know, try to be strong in my might, but the verse says, no, be strong in the Lord. That's the source of your strength. It doesn't come from you. It's not internal. It's external. And that's also something very important for us to remember whenever we do go through things. It's not about how strong I am. It's about how strong the God that I serve is. So.
Did I say something?
Yes, sir.
I had occasion in my lifetime to work in stalls. Mm-hmm. Being out there when there's light in the trees, when there's light and all around. I saw a tree lit up and the whole tree lit up. And I've seen lots of stalls, all kinds of stalls, ice and all. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we see that Jesus has power over weather. Power over weather. Another point that we can make, we won't spend much time with this one, but He also had power over life. And we'll stay away from the human aspect of this because I think Mike wanted us to focus more on the nature aspect of it. So what are some instances that Jesus performed a miracle that didn't affect people, but it was still in the realm of nature? Does anything come to mind? I found at least two. Yeah. Yeah, so He cursed the fig tree. Okay, so that's the plant kingdom. What about the animal kingdom? What miracles involved animals? Okay. Okay, yeah, that would definitely be a miracle. Specifically, though, I think we're supposed to say within the ministry of Jesus. So, but yeah, that's a good one. That's definitely the case. Yeah, that's the one I was looking for. The coin in the fish's mouth, and then also the instance whenever Jesus is walking on the shore, the disciples are in the boat, and He tells them to cast the net on the other side of the boat. Something was going on with the fish there. I don't know what, but fish don't just stay on one side of the boat. So yeah, he had power over weather. He had power over life. And the rest of our time this morning, we'll spend talking about Matthew 14. Matthew 14. Are there any other comments on Jesus influencing weather or things like that? What was the purpose of these miracles? To confirm His message. Okay. Specifically to His disciples, what was He trying to emphasize to them? His identity? And what did you say? Okay. Yeah.
I think in all cases, every miracle is a form of one.
Mm-hmm. Right. That'd be another case, yeah. We could use that one too. Okay, very good. All right, Matthew 14, we'll go 22 to 23. Dennis, would you like to read that?
We're saying right here that okay. As far as the purpose of miracles, the New Testament tells us very specifically what the purpose of miracles was. Mm-hmm. It was to confirm the Word, it was to confirm Him as Christ, and was to fulfill prophecy. And all three of those are very clearly told to us in the New Testament.
Right.
What the purpose of miracles was.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Would you read verses 22 to 33 of Matthew 14? Yes, sir.
22 through 33. Immediately, Jesus made His disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side while He sent the multitudes away. And when He had sent the multitudes away, He went upon the mountain by Himself to pray. And when evening came, He was alone there. The boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. When the disciples saw Him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it's I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered Him and said, "Lord, if it is You, command me to come to You on the water." So He said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out His hand and caught him and said to him, "O ye of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased.
Okay.
Is that it?
In verse 33, okay. Please.
Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God."
Okay. Keep your finger there and turn to Mark 6. We'll look at three different instances. I think they're all the same account, simply because they all occur after the feeding of the 5,000. I think it makes sense that they would all be the same account. Mark 6. All right. Would someone like to read verses 45 to 52?
He made his disciples get up into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed from the mountain to pray. And on the evening day, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straying at noon, for the wind was against him. Now, about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and he would have passed them by. And when they saw him, he was walking on the sea, and supposing it was a boat, he cried out. But they all saw him and were troubled, and immediately he talked to them. "Be of good cheer, and do not be afraid." They decided, "Do not be afraid." And he went up to the boat to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves, and on this marvel. For they were not understood about their clothes, because their heart was hardened.
Okay. And then one more, turn to John 6. John 6. Bobby, would you like to read verses 15 to 21, please?
Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Now when the evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over by the sea towards Capernaum. And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going.
Okay. Back in Matthew 14, our first text. What watch was it? Which watch? It was the fourth? Does anyone know what time frame that is? Which period? So the Jews broke up, their time was broken up into essentially 12-hour periods. From 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening, that was the work day. That's when everything was essentially taken care of and done. After 6, everything pretty much shut down. And so the remaining 12 hours of the day were broken up into 4 watches. The first watch was 6, as soon as the day ended, to 9. Second was 9 to midnight. Third was midnight to 3. And then the fourth was 3 to 6. So they had been seemingly rowing all night, trying to get through this storm to the other side of the sea. We find that again in verse 25. This isn't groundbreaking, but I did think it was interesting. Look in verse 28. Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water." Other verses use command instead of bid. Does anyone have that? Is that the New King James? Okay. So it uses command me to come out with thee on the water. Why do you think he would ask Jesus to command him? I don't think necessarily a point can be made. I think it's just interesting that he says, "Don't just let me come out in the water. Command me to come out in the water."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if he commanded him,
then it was possible. Yeah.
Possible for him.
That makes sense. Did you have something? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good point. And then in verse 29, notice how he responds. The word come there is an imperative. So he didn't just command him. He commanded him with the strongest form of language in the Greek, with an imperative, come. Like, it's expected of you now. This is something that you have to do. So I just thought that was interesting. I'd never noticed that before.
He made a command.
Yeah. Yeah, so Peter asked for a command, and he got one. So, let me ask you another question. What are some other passages that record God's presence on the water? God's presence on the water. Any specific instance stand out in your mind?
Genesis, the Holy Spirit went across the water.
Yeah, so Genesis 1, verse 2. We'll go ahead. You want to read that for us, Chad? Chapter 1, verse 2.
The earth was without form and void, darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
Okay. I also found a really interesting verse back in the book of Job, if you'd like to turn over there. Look at me in Job 9 and verse 8. Job 9 and verse 8. Someone like to read that?
He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea.
You notice that? I've never seen that verse before. He treads on the waves of the sea. I just thought it was cool. I thought it was a cool connection. So, any comments, questions so far? Okay. All right. Back in Matthew 14, look in verse 27 now. Verse 27. The King James Version, whenever it's quoting Jesus, says, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." What do other versions have? What does the New King James have? Same exact thing. Okay. So the phrase "be of good cheer" there is another Greek word. It says tharsetai. So it's one Greek word. It actually means have courage. So it doesn't mean be of good cheer. It doesn't mean take heart, which is what some translations use. It means be courageous, take courage. Which in the context, which we'll get into in just a few minutes, I think it's interesting. You know, he's telling them, guys, be courageous. The next phrase that he uses is ego a me. Does that stand out to anyone? It should not be translated, it is I. That's not what he's saying. The literal translation is, I am. Now, I'm not sure if he's referring to John 8:58 or the book of Exodus, I am that I am. I don't think we can definitely say that. But literally, that phrase should be translated, I am. So, I think it's interesting that in this context, in their moment of fear and their moment of, you know, we're really not sure if we're going to make it through this storm, through this wind, he shows up, he says, be of good courage, also I am, perhaps as a reminder. So, again, an interesting observation. I don't think we could dogmatically say that he's referring to the book of Exodus or anything along those lines, but I think it is an interesting point.
Its counterpart in the Greek is normally translated as I, even I, and it's normally God talking to himself. And again, you see a whole I, even I, he's repeating himself, so the importance of it.
Yeah. Okay. Are you saying that you see that here in this passage, or?
The ego and me can either, like you said, be I am, or can be translated as I, even I.
Oh, okay.
And then you see its counterpart in Hebrew is translated as I, even I, and it's normally God talking of himself.
Okay. Interesting. All right, and then that third phrase, it says, do not be afraid. I believe in the New King James, is that right? Do not be afraid. Be not afraid in the King James. That word means do not be cowardly. So it isn't don't be afraid. It's don't be cowardly. Now, let's go ahead and have this discussion. What do you think the difference is between the two? What's the difference in fear and cowardice?
Cowardice is behind fear to manipulate you. The negative sins keep you out of, you know, the situation, perhaps, where bravery would be overcoming the fear.
Yeah.
You felt the fear, but you overcame and continued on.
Okay. What would be some examples? Let's use the scripture. What are some examples in scripture that you can think of when someone was cowardly? So they came into contact with something that they feared and they did. If they didn't attempt to overcome, they simply backed away. Does anything come to mind?
Jonah?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it rendered him essentially to the point where he did nothing. He backed away and he would say, I would rather do nothing than to even make an effort. And it's interesting, you see, that can be seen a lot of times in people. That's many times the response is, well, I don't think I can do it completely, so I won't do it at all. And so I back away, and I would rather do nothing than do something.
Despise.
Despise? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, in all honesty, I think the children of Israel had seen miracles that were, I don't want to say more amazing, but they were on a larger scale than anything that Jesus ever did, you know. Moses is parting the Red Sea, and they'd seen the effects of the plagues, and just this entire nation that had fallen to its knees, and yet they didn't have faith. I think that's interesting. And so whenever you hear people make the comment, you know, well, if I could just see a miracle, then I would believe. I don't know. I'm not sure, because the disciples, the context of this passage right before, the reason that Jesus was on the mountain in the first place was because he had just fed the 5,000. So he had just fed the 5,000. The disciples had witnessed this. They had taken up the baskets of the bread. The baskets of the bread was probably in the boat with them, for crying out loud. And yet they forgot. They allowed that fear, that basic instinct for self-preservation, to take over their minds.
What about Peter when he was in challenge?
Yeah.
You've got to be one of his disciples, and he was at the point of curse and rejected and denied. That's cowardice, not to stand up.
Yeah.
And the rest of his disciples fled.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting, though, in both of these situations, you see Peter at least making an effort when the other disciples didn't. So in the garden, Peter takes out his sword and he chops off Malchus's ear. And then here, at least he gets out of the boat. Sometimes I think we might be a little harsh on Peter. You know, well, he got out in the water and he saw the wind and he got kind of fearful and he started sinking. Well, everyone else is back in the boat. They should have all asked if they could come out in the water. But they didn't. And so at least Peter made an attempt. And yes, he was still maturing in his faith, but he still made an effort, which I think is commendable. So what was the problem? Peter gets out of the boat. He starts walking on the water. What happened? I'm sorry? Yeah, so notice how significant that is, though. What do you think he had been focusing on before he saw the wind?
Jesus.
Yeah. He had his eye on something that he was supposed to have his eye on, and then when he lost his focus and he started focusing on the things around him, that's when things started going badly. And have you ever thought about the fact that, you know, if you've ever gone to, you know, out to the lake or to a pool or something, you know that if someone is sinking, they don't have time to say, Lord, help me, before they're completely submerged. And so obviously, I think we could make the argument that the process of, once he starts seeing the wind and he starts doubting, the sinking doesn't occur all at once. Because he starts sinking and he's, you know, he sees what's going on, he asks for help, and the Lord helps him. I think that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And so essentially what happened is he's focusing on his circumstances rather than on Christ. It reminds me of a passage in Hebrews, right? Does anyone think of the passage offhand? Hebrews 12:2. We'll go ahead and turn over there. Hebrews 12:2. You know what? Go ahead and read verse 1 also. Someone read that, please. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2. Curtis, you got that?
Okay. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a crowd of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.
You know, that's amazing. In chapter 11, we've just come through the hall of faith, if you like. And, you know, he's talking about all these people and how they'd overcome all these terrible things. And he says, since we had such a great a cloud of witnesses, all these people that came before you, they endured these terrible things. You can too. The Hebrews is a very long pep talk. It's the writer is trying to convince his readers to not go back to Judaism, but to stay with the faith, to stay strong, to stay faithful, to stay focused. And then notice what he says there in verse 2. So look at the people that have gone before you, the people that have suffered these terrible things, suffered things that are worse than you're suffering now, and they were consistent. They maintained the faith. And then he says in verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. I think it's very important that we pay attention to what we focus on. Where are my eyes? What am I looking toward? Because whenever problems occur, and problems occur, the Christian life is a wonderful life, but it's not an easy life. It was never meant to be. So when problems arise, what do I focus on? Am I focusing on the problem? Am I focusing on the situation? Or am I focusing on the one that's in the storm with me? Because Jesus wasn't isolated from the wind and the waves. He was walking on the water. And he was going through the same storm that Peter was. But Peter lost his focus, and that's when the sinking starts to occur.
And I find it interesting, have for many years, that in verse 1, when he arrived, said, and he talks about, let us lay aside every weight and listen to sin which so easily besets us.
Yeah.
He's not talking about my sin, your sin, or something that is a bigger challenge to me or fair challenge to you. He's talking about the sin. What sin was it? He just gave him the example of faith.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that the biggest problem that people have? We let our faith wane.
That's right.
We let it go. And then he answers the question. He answers or gives a solution in verse 2. Who is the author and finisher of our faith? Exactly what we've been talking about. Who we focus on.
Yeah.
Who we have our eyes on. So that sin which so easily besets or ensnares us is our lack of faith, our failure in faith. And then look to who to revive that faith. Where do we get that faith?
Mm-hmm.
It's not around the world.
Yeah.
Don't look to Royce for your faith.
Yeah.
Look to Christ for your faith.
Yeah, and that echoes something that we mentioned just a few minutes ago. Don't look to yourself either. You know, you're not the author and finisher of your faith. It's Christ. Find strength in the Lord and in the strength of His might, not in yourself, because that's just as bad as having a lack of faith. And many times I think that can reflect a lack of faith when I try to do things on my own, when I try to be self-sufficient, when I try to rely on my own strength, which is many times what we do when problems arise. It's not good for us. It's not good for us mentally. It's not good for us physically. It's not good for us spiritually. We need to rely on someone other than ourselves.
Yeah, the point there, I think, is finishing.
Yeah.
We focus too much on the small battles all throughout life. The battles that we lose sometimes.
Yeah.
The battles that we win. But those are just small battles. The actual victory is in death.
Mm-hmm.
We draw our last breath. We finish our course, as Paul said, and we won.
Yeah. Yeah.
We won't lose. But when the children, you know, everything we do in life, you have to concentrate on the finish. Stay focused on the finish.
Yeah. I was watching something this weekend. It was a documentary on ultramarathons. I don't know if you've ever heard of those, but it's this race that's 106 miles. And these guys take 36 hours to do this race, and it's all through the mountains, and it's more hiking than it is running. But it's covering these guys, and, you know, it's a 36-hour cutoff, so if you don't finish, then you don't finish sort of thing. And so these guys have, like, 10 miles to go, and their muscles are all gone, and they've got blisters everywhere, and they're bleeding, and they're just, they haven't slept, and they're tired, and they're hungry. And it just shows that they refuse to stop moving. They're not running anymore. They can't run, but they're walking. And then when they can't walk anymore, they're still hobbling. They just refuse to stop moving. I think that's a very good... I don't know what a good word would be. I think it's a very good example of what we should be like as Christians. You know, at the beginning of that race, you're going to feel clean, you're going to feel good, you're going to feel fresh and strong. And there are going to be highs and lows throughout the rest of that 106 miles. But even when you go through the lows, just keep moving. You know, it's, you know, regardless of what happens, just don't stop. Just keep moving forward, even if you're essentially crawling. Just don't stop moving. So, Catherine, do you have something? Okay, she was stretching. Yes.
Because you're saying also that in Hebrews 12 passage, it basically goes in verse 2 and then getting back to the proclamation. In Hebrews 12 2, it says looking at Jesus, and we're looking at Jesus, but it also says that he was looking to him. It says he was looking at the joy that was set before him. So, like we're supposed to look to Jesus, even Jesus was looking ahead of him.
Yeah.
Heaven. And that was the same thing about the proclamation. The spies said we're like grasshoppers in their sight. Instead of saying they're grasshoppers in our sight. You know, a lot of times we tend to do that for how we feel with respect to them instead of thinking bigger and the goals set before us. And how does God see them?
Yeah. How do they see those? That's a cool perspective. Good point. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
If we want to. One thing to keep in mind, if we want to use Hebrews as an example of like losing faith, you know, this was written to people who were, they were being persecuted, some were being killed, they were being ostracized by the Jewish, you know, their Jewish family, their friends, business people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was written to people who were, some were abandoning Christianity to return to Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to bear that in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the context of the book of Hebrews makes that passage even stronger of just knowing who's being written to and what they were experiencing when they read those things. So very good. So covering Jesus' power over physical laws, I think we could probably say that walking on water would have something to do with gravity. I don't know. As opposed to changing the density of the water, or I have no idea. What's another example of Jesus not being held by gravity without giving it away? You say it? His ascension, right? Yeah. So, okay, good. I had a few discussion questions I wanted to talk about. Jesus had this amazing ability to make every moment a teaching moment, which is exactly what my dad was like. He's still like, he's every moment's a teaching moment. How can we imitate that consistency in child rearing? How can we imitate that consistency in child rearing?
First.
Yeah, not necessarily even what you talk about, but how you behave. Because if you behave one way, but then you talk another way, the kids are going to be confused and more than likely rebellious, right? It's not going to turn out well. Would you agree? Okay. Go to Deuteronomy 6. This is one passage I wanted to emphasize for a moment. Deuteronomy 6. Chapter 6 and verse 7 says, "And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. Thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. Where do you think the balance should be struck between this, Deuteronomy 6, 7 through 9, and not provoking your children to wrath in Ephesians? Do you think there's a balance that has to be struck there? Where do you think that balance is? I'm asking for my own information, not because I have an answer in mind. So.
I think it's impatience.
Okay.
I think it's impatience because, you know, if you're using all these teaching moments like to get on with your kids all the time, maybe in the delivery.
Yeah.
Are you trying to teach them patiently, or are you trying to bring things down and feel like you're never doing what's right?
Yeah, so the way that it's done rather than how much it's done. I think that's a good way of looking at it.
You always keep Jesus before
them. Mm-hmm.
Whether it's getting onto, or whether it's teaching example, or whether it's walking down the road and seeing things, you always keep Jesus before them.
Mm-hmm.
In a positive way.
Yeah.
And that instills a knowledge, a love, an admiration, a respect.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things that constant, and I don't mean beating, but just an explanation. This is where this came from. Look how powerful he is to do this, or when you have storms, and that's something that I really didn't do a good job of because I was really afraid of storms. So I didn't teach my children well, and it shows in my daughter, not my son. He overcame that. So we can give them an advantage or a step up if we teach them the power and the awesomeness of God.
Yeah.
And his abilities.
Yeah. And I think the argument could even be made that initially your children's relationship with God will never be greater than your relationship with God. You know? And so initially, of course, there is a growth process that takes place, you know, once they get older and they understand for themselves. But if I don't love God, my children will not love God unless they take it upon themselves to learn to love God. And so really the quality of my relationship with him is very drastically going to affect their relationship with him moving forward. And I think you see at least a shadow of that in how Jesus responds with his disciples. He was patient with them. You know, he was loving, he was tender, but there were times it's like, guys, I just fed 5,000 people with a few loaves and a couple fish. Where's your faith? You know, I'm here with you, and I think you also see a transition. He's very encouraging when he's walking on the water towards them, but then when he gets in the boat and they're still afraid, that's when you see a hint of a rebuke. Because I'm here now, why are you still afraid? And that goes back to what Anna said. It's all about his presence in these passages. It's not bad to be afraid. It's bad to be afraid when I'm with you. My presence should make the difference in those levels of fear. So this morning we got into Jesus' power over nature, specifically over weather, over life, and then over physical laws. So any closing comments or questions? Yes.
You know, when it talks about like sitting in thy house and walking by the way and life, that's just the things that we don't normally take the time to think about, take for granted.
Yeah.
You know, just that not when all things are going wrong that you would just talk to them about, or everything just seems, oh, we got this and we got new stuff, you know, talk about the grace of God and things like that. But just when you're waking up, slowing down to just take every moment and thank God and put that in their forefront.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. All right. Thank you very much.